If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Dear Colgate, I love that you love that I love being at home. You even let me whiten my teeth from home.
Because you know how I feel about getting up from my cloud couch.
The Colgate Optic White LED Kit gives professional level results in just 10 minutes a day for 10 days when used as directed.
And that's why, Colgate, I want you to meet my parents. Because ever since meeting you, I've been living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. On today's podcast, we've got a conversation with the award-winning historian Serhii Plocke. Serhii's most recent book is Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, an untold story of World War II, which explores the experiences of US servicemen stationed on three air bases in Ukraine in the final years of the conflict. It was a US-Soviet collaboration that began with high hopes, but whose fallout would fuel the Cold War. BBC World History's editor, Matt Elton, met up with him in London to find out more.
What, for people who might not be familiar, is your new book about?
My book is about the fall of the Grand Alliance. This is a book about transition from World War II to the Cold War. And it deals with this big topic, looking at a number of personalities and very particular places. And personalities and places are not exactly very familiar to people who read about the Grand Alliance or read about the start of the Cold War. Those people resided for approximately 1 year, a little bit more than that, at the three air bases, which were on the territory of the Soviet Union. Now it is the territory of Ukraine, at Poltava, Mirgorod, and Pryatyn. And that was the only case when the Americans and the Soviets fought side by side together. Because one thing about the Grand Alliance was that it was also a very strange alliance where there was an agreement that the US and UK is advancing or not advancing on the Western Front, and the Soviets would launch an offensive or go on defense on Eastern Front. But there was no real combat where the Soviets and the Western allies would fight together. And those three places were the only place where that happened. So it's a big theme, but it's also a lot. I'm trying to pay a lot of attention to particular people and particular places.
It's an extraordinary story, and one that I certainly hadn't heard much about before I read the book. For people who might not know, first, what do we mean when we say the Grand Alliance? What does that define?
Well, Grand Alliance, of course, like many other wonderful things, like, well, wonderful or not so wonderful, like Iron Curtain, were coined by Winston Churchill. And Grand Alliance, this is the title of one of the volumes in his series of World War II memoirs. So Grand Alliance, it's an alliance between the United States, the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom was there first in the war, and then the Soviet Union. And that was the alliance that emerged victorious in the Second World War. And those three leaders, first at Tehran and then at Yalta, really, in many ways, created the world that we live in today. And just one simple example is the Security Council of the United Nations. Many are unhappy with it today, but again, it is there, it is working, and that's the creation of the Grand Alliance, the United Nations itself, the creation of Grand Alliance. So it's a big, big part of the story and history of the 20th century. Again, I'm trying to approach that people like Roosevelt and Stalin and Churchill are very much part of my story. But it's also, I look at the way how their decisions influenced people on the ground, people in the trenches, so to speak. And trenches I use metaphorically because my people were airmen. So those were air bases. But again, that's where they were together fighting Nazi Germany.
I think that's what fascinates me about the book so much, is this connection between this big sort of political strategy and these experiences of people in a very specific place on the ground and in the air, as you say. Did people go into this strategy of moving American airmen onto kind of Russian soil, as it was at the time, go into it with the hope that it would be the start of a grander alliance then?
You're absolutely right. There were really high hopes that there would be more cooperation and more air bases in particular. So the soil per se was Ukrainian at that time and today, but it was part of the Soviet Union. But the hope was that the Americans will show how good they are as allies. And as a result of that, Stalin would agree to allow them to create air bases in the Soviet forest, so on the Russian soil today, because no one knew at that time, and they were started planning those air bases in 1943. They went into action in 44, continued until 45. So no one knew at that time that the atomic bomb would actually work. No one knew whether they were going to use it as against Germany or Japan. And the expectations were that there would be hundreds of thousands of Americans who would die in the war for Japanese homeland. And one part of the plan was, of course, involve the Soviet Union in fight against Japan. But another was to allow the American air bases to establish air bases on the Soviet territory, in that way actually easier getting to the to Japan. So there was that vision. One part of it was strengthening the alliance as a whole, becoming real allies, not just in terms of coordination, but fighting together. And then there was also a very specific goal as well.
Who dreamt up this idea, and how did they persuade Stalin to agree to it?
Oh, it wasn't easy. The idea was born with General Arnold, who was really a key figure in designing the American air war during the Second World War. And they had a really major problem in 1943 when they started planning for that. And that they couldn't effectively really bomb the German targets in Central Europe and Eastern Europe. And Eastern Europe was occupied, mostly was occupied by Germany at that time. The bombers needed protection of the fighter planes, and at that point they didn't have the right fighter planes. So they came up with the idea which was called shuttle bombing. What that means, that meant that the bombers, B-17, flying fortresses, and later that they would be protected by Mustangs, the fighter planes, they would take off from the airfields in UK and in Italy later, bomb their targets in Central and Eastern Europe, land on the Soviet territory, refuel, get new ammunition, and then and bombs, and then fly back and do bombing again, instead of going to Central Europe and then coming back. So that was the plan in terms of the immediate goals of what those air bases were created for.
And how did they choose which men worked and served in these bases?
On the one hand, they wanted to get people who would be familiar with culture and maybe with language. Not all of them, but significant percentage of them were. But another challenge that they had, that they knew that a lot of people who come from the region, they were not really great fans of Mr. Stalin or of the Bolshevik Revolution. Many of them were either themselves or children of refugees. So they were looking really for people who had that background, linguistic, cultural, and otherwise, but would be still friendly toward the Soviet Union. And they more or less succeeded in getting a fair number of those people. But others were just average people. They were looking for the crews that would be working on the ground, mechanics and people dealing with radio and so on and so forth, and the air wings that were flying to Poltava, those were anybody. They were coming there just for maybe a few days, maximum for 1 week. If the weather was not good, they couldn't take off and fly back. But those people who were on the ground, and there was approximately 1,000 of those people, maybe 10% of those had some relation to language and culture.
And what was the experience? What was the kind of reaction of these two countries' people when they first got together in these bases? How did they do that?
Well, it was excitement. It was excitement on both sides. They opened the bases in April and May of 1944. The image of the Soviet Union is extremely positive at that time. This is already after the Battle of Stalingrad. This is after the Battle of Kursk. And Americans are excited to see the Allies, to work with them, and the Soviets are excited as well. They have the first bombing raid and the first, which was called Frantic One. It was 2 days before D-Day. So they get the news, all of them get the news about the D-Day, the opening of the second front, when they're at Poltava and at those bases. So it's really a fantastic story of work and cooperation and camaraderie and so on and so forth. So it starts really on a very high note. It unfortunately doesn't end on that note.
No. Are there some particular episodes or characters or stories that you think really illustrate this sense of getting on with each other?
One of those things where they really worked nicely together was the building of those bases, and that is certainly one thing. Another thing was when the flying fortresses were flying to Poltava. Those were joint crews of mechanics that worked on them. So there would be a person in charge would be normally an American, but there would be a couple people under him. There was a language barrier, but still they managed to deal with that. Those were the examples. Again, the Soviets would not allow their own people to get into B-17 and to fly on those missions. But again, occasionally that was happening. And of course, then the counterintelligence, which was called SMERSH, death to spies, would get into the picture. And the longer the bases were there, the less there was cooperation, the more important not the Soviet air commanders, but the secret policemen would become. And the turning point really in that really wonderful relationship, which it's not in the book, but I would call them maybe a honeymoon or something like that in that relationship, comes less than 1 month after the bases were opened. On June 22nd, 1944, this operation, the Frantic II, the fortresses, the flying fortresses came to Poltava and to Mirgorod. And this time around, actually, Germans already knew what was going on. And they located those airplanes. They were actually sparkling silver, so it was very easy to see them from the sky. And those were the largest they attacked during nighttime, and those were the heaviest losses of the American airplanes on the ground since Pearl Harbor. So after that, the relationship started to go south. The Americans expected that the Soviets would protect them with their fighter planes, with their anti-aircraft fire. And that didn't happen, not because the Soviets didn't want to, but it turned out that they were not really equipped to do that. The fighter planes were supposed to fight during night, but they didn't have radar systems, for example. And the anti-aircraft fire turned out to be very ineffective. So no one single German airplane, Luftwaffe, was even damaged, to say nothing about shot during that attack. And that was where relations again started to be quite tense.
Did the two sides openly blame each other for this incident?
They did, it depends on what openly really means. So yes, in public, in media, there was a military censorship. They would not write about that or talk about that. So that never reached the American or British or any media. But in the relationship between the commanders, they were clearly that's what they're saying. And the Soviets were saying, okay, we told them that it was wrong to put one airplane next to another. You have to disperse them in the field. And the Americans would say, okay, we thought that you would protect us. We were based for more than 1 year in Britain and then less than that in Italy. And everywhere we were protected. It's the only place where we're not protected. And the U.S. commanders then said, okay, you can protect us. Allow us to bring our own anti-aircraft guns and allow us to bring our night fighters. And the Soviets, of course, didn't want to do that because that means more Americans on the sacred Soviet soil. That means more exposure on the part of a local population to the Americans. And that's something that the Stalin's regime didn't think that was a good idea.
That's a good point, actually. What did the local populations make of these people from America?
Well, it's a great question because the air bases were located in the areas that less than a year before the Americans came, more like half a year or something like that, were part of the German occupation. So Germans came to that part of Ukraine in the summer of 1941. They left it in the fall of 1943, and then in the spring of 44, the Americans came. So that was already a second foreign army on that territory at that time. And the local population had really high hopes because that was also meant opening of the Soviet Union to the United States, to the West, to the Allies. So some people, and the secret police was there, of course, recording that. That's how we know all of that. So some people were saying, okay, that means that really a major transformation of the political order is coming, that the party will not be running things anymore. Others were thinking more in terms, okay, the Germans wanted to capture this territory through war, and Americans are coming and just trying to take it over without the war. So there were different opinions out there, but overall the attitude was very positive. Attitude was very positive, and the comparison that they were making between the American and Soviet soldiers were not in favor of the Soviet, not in favor of the Red Army, the way how they behaved, how they were dressed, and so on.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The achievements of the Grand Alliance were huge, but even bigger was disappointment that it didn't last longer, when in reality most of the alliances don't go beyond reaching the common objectives. So but there were this huge expectation really that the big disappointment with the start of the Cold War. And what I'm trying to say that people who were already on the ground, who dealt directly and closely with the Soviets, for them Cold War started already in 1944.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Did the German bombing incident you mentioned increase suspicion in the Soviet quarters of the Americans?
Not of the Americans, but that actually added to the sense of a deep-seated sense of inferiority that the Soviets had, because the Americans had of course much more superior aircrafts. A lot of what Soviets had were American aircrafts that were supplied through land lease, or the Soviet aircrafts that were built, they were modeled on the Americans to start with. The way how the Americans were supplied with spare parts, how they were dressed and so on and so forth. So there was this sense of inferiority in cultural terms, and also in terms, okay, there was a super effective and very rich kind of a country with well-supplied army, when the Soviets really didn't have that. And now it turned out that they can't protect them as well. So the idea already so that happened in late June. In July, the relationship between the two countries became really very bad. And by August, Molotov already started to demand the Americans out. They wanted them out. There was also other reason. The Soviet army launched a very successful offensive campaign on the Eastern Front in June of 1944. So the air bases ended up within 3 weeks after they were established, really relatively deep in the Soviet rear, and the Soviets didn't think that actually they were benefiting too much from all of that. At least if you look at the risks that they were taking, exposing their own population to Americans, quite a few of those Americans would speak Russian or Ukrainian, which presented another major problems. So they wanted them out as soon as possible, eventually they got rid of two bases by September and October of 1944, and allowed just only one base to stay, and it was mostly a skeleton type of crew that stayed there, anywhere between approximately 200 people, and it started with more than 1,000.
One other factor that interests me that you write about in the book is the different attitudes between the two sides about kind of relationships with women.
Oh yeah, that's
how did that affect things?
Well, that was a major. It was a big part of the story that led to those tensions, and Soviets. They really just acted like the issues related to dating or sex in the Red Army didn't exist. And one of the outcomes of that was, of course, mass rape of, for example, German women and women in Eastern Europe. U.S. position was that, yes, the Soviets told them that the American airmen, GIs, are not supposed to date the women in the uniform, so women in the Red Army. But it was expected that they would be their allies, that they would be allowed to date civilian women, like that was the case in Britain again. There were good memories, bad memories about that. Like that was the case in France as well. In the Soviet Union, they actually allowed and even encouraged that kind of dating as long as they thought they needed the Americans. And they thought they needed the Americans before the opening of the Second Front. So one of the reasons why Stalin agreed to open the bases was to accommodate Roosevelt's request for that, because he wanted the Second Front. Once the Second Front was there, one of the reasons to be nice to the Americans disappeared. Then once they moved the frontier as a result, the Soviets, I mean, as a result of that offensive, there was one less reason to have the Americans there. And then there was embarrassment of not being able to protect them. So by July of 1944, what you see are the military counterintelligence groups and the civilian secret police is going there and actually openly harassing women whom the Americans were dating. And resentment toward rich Americans dating the locals, either in Britain or in France, was there, certainly. But nowhere there was a secret police going there and trying to break the relationships that originally they encouraged to develop. That certainly added to the frictions. And I mentioned that most of the people who came to the bases wanted to go there. They wanted to work together, fight together with the Soviets. That they were, in today's word, Sovietophile, Russophiles, or something like that. And with very few exceptions. By the fall of 1944, and then the last base, the Poltava base, existed until June 1945. Most of them go back being sworn enemies of the regime. And one thing that they couldn't actually understand or couldn't forgive the regime was the fact that it was actually a police state, the fact that that was the regime that was trying also to interfere with their relationship with the local population. The regime where the officials actually openly lied to them. So very few cases out of those 1,000 people who were there on basis permanently left still being Sovietophile. It's a very different story with the pilots who were flying there, because they were flying there for 2-3 days. They were not really exposed to all these things. They were just would get a good sleep, rest, get back into their planes and fly back. But those who were there, more than 1,000 people, and very few would leave the country still being appreciative of the regime. Many of them developed good relationships with the locals, that they liked the people, but the regime, that was something that few of them had any illusions about the Stalin's regime.
You define in the book the reason for that as being a difference of political culture, because their aims were alike. They both wanted the same thing, yet it was the culture politically of these two nations that caused this rift.
Exactly. It was, again, when I started researching that and I noticed that was the trajectory, my original hypothesis was that it was a culture in general. So, okay, language barrier and people behave differently and so on and so forth. And by the time I finished the book, I kind of narrowed that to particularly political culture. The Soviets never could understand how the Americans could tell them that, okay, they didn't like FDR and were going to vote for somebody else. They couldn't understand why they were during the October Revolution Day. They would go and listen for hours for speeches that they didn't understand and why they were supposed to be clapping. They never didn't understand the power that the counterintelligence and secret police had over the officers and generals, including generals in the Red Army that they were dealing with. And how duplicitous the Soviets were in trying to break the relationship with local women. On the one hand, saying, okay, we are protecting you because they're really prostitutes and we don't want you to get all sorts of diseases. On the other hand, telling these women that, okay, the Americans are really spies and encouraging them and recruiting them to spy on those Americans. And all of that, those women were bringing back to their American boyfriends. So all of that was known.
Did the disillusionment that American people felt who were involved in this experience feed outwards into the distrust after the war that led to the collapse of the Grand Alliance? Or was it just that the cultures never changed, so the two underlying factors were still in place?
Well, the one thing that certainly happened, people who were at this basis, or people who directly were involved with issues at the basis, some of them were quite prominent people, like the U.S. Ambassador Averell Harriman, or the commander of the base was General Walsh, who became then one of the leading commanders in the American sphere of occupation in Germany. They became the first Cold Warriors. And again, that was again a part of the experience around those bases, because one big story was that the Soviets refused to allow the American and British airplanes to use those bases to resupply the Polish rebels, the Polish uprising that was going on in Warsaw at that time. So eventually it was the Germans destroyed the resistance and destroyed the city of Warsaw as a result of that. They never were able to understand how the Soviets treated their own prisoners of war, but also absolutely neglected the agreements that they signed at Yalta about protecting the American prisoners of war that were liberated by the Red Army from the prisoner of war camps in Germany. That was a big issue, again, cultural issue, and it's about political culture, where not just people at the bases, not just Averell Harriman, but President of the United States Roosevelt himself felt appalled. He just wrote that signed at least the harshest telegram that he ever sent to Stalin was around the issue of Stalin refusing to allow the use of Poltava bases to bring in the American prisoners of war and then to help to transport them to Iran and through Iran to the United States eventually. So that was a big part of the story. So it was political culture at the end.
Are there any people whose role in this story you think hasn't been told sufficiently or that you think has been underserved?
You're talking about the literature that we have already on the history of the Second World War. Well, someone like Avril Harriman, of course, got a lot of attention. But I bring people who are exactly there on the basis. One of them was General Walsh. Then two very interesting characters in my story are people who, after the experience at Poltava, decided to dedicate their life to the study of the Soviet Union. They end up together. Franklin Holtzman was one of them, and George Fisher. They ended up at Harvard doing their PhDs there. And the last chapter in my book, it really comes from 1954, 1955, when the same officer, the counterintelligence officer who was at Poltava, now was stationed in Washington, D.C., and he was trying to recruit one of his friends, one of his colleagues from Poltava. So it's kind of a full circle. So the most of the book deals really with the Second World War, but you have this all-important continuation in the first years and the first decade of the Cold War, and these are the very same people with their experiences at those bases. Not all of them, Holtzman, for example, and Fisher, again, they despised Stalinism, but Fisher, till the last days of his life, was really very leftist and socialist in the United States. So it wasn't really about ideology, because many of those people were left-leaning at the very start. So it wasn't about culture per se, not about ideology, and not about, as you mentioned, goals in the war, because they shared. But there was one thing which is I define as political culture that just didn't allow that alliance to last.
We should mention the title of your book, which is quite striking. What is it, and who does it refer to?
Thank you. The title is Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front. Subtitle is An Untold Story of World War II. So the subtitle, I think, I just explained. But the main title comes from the fact that after the Soviets insisted that most of Americans would leave the bases, 200 people who stayed there, they felt like they were abandoned by their own government. They were forgotten. And they called themselves Forgotten Bastards of Ukraine. So that was the name that they invented for themselves. I later realized that they were not very original, because there was another group of people who called them Forgotten Bastards, and those were, it seems to me, Forgotten Bastards of Iceland or something like that. So again, there was an American outpost there that felt forgotten. And that's where the title is coming from. Again, we change, we put Eastern Front instead of Ukraine to really place the title of the book and the book itself in the context of the Second World War, as opposed to any other moment in history.
You write that the winds of the new Cold War are becoming chillier by the day. What lessons are there in this book for us in the present, do you think?
Well, the lesson is not, of course, don't go and don't create alliances with people that, or countries or regimes that don't share your political culture. This is not the argument. But you have to create alliances. And again, the Grand Alliance and the alliance with the Soviet Union was a major factor in defeat of Nazi Germany. But you don't have to have your expectations too high in terms of once the immediate goal, which you share, geopolitical goal or otherwise, is achieved, don't expect that alliance to last for too long. And Grand Alliance is a very interesting example of that, because there were three participants, and the two of them, United Kingdom and United States, actually continued to be on very friendly relations through the Cold War. So just one country that wasn't stopped being part of the alliance, and the Cold War started. It would be an oversimplification to explain all of that just by political culture, and I'm not trying to do that. But I'm convinced, and I'm really very insistent, that political culture was part of that. For the Soviet Union falling out and the UK and US sticking together. Okay, not the only thing, but that was part of the story.
So how can we counter for that? How can we get around that being a major obstacle?
That means that from the very beginning you have to start planning already for post-alliance part. And the achievements of the Grand Alliance were huge, but even bigger was disappointment that it didn't last longer, when in reality most of the alliances don't go beyond reaching the common objectives. So, but there were this huge expectation really that the big disappointment with the start of the Cold War. And what I'm trying to say that people who were already on the ground, who dealt directly and closely with the Soviets, for them Cold War started already in 1944. And one of people whose memoirs, who was at one of the bases and whose memoirs I quote here, he was saying that really that was a precursor to the Cold War. He writes, of course, post factum from his perspective in the 1990s, but that is his assessment, and I fully agree with him. And it's also very interesting that he was a farmer from Middle West in the United States, but I thought that he gave the most accurate assessment of what happened there, when quite a few of people who became intellectuals, who were intellectuals at that time, were really lost and were trying to figure out what was going on. But that farmer actually nailed it down for himself. And I thought, okay, that's after years of research, that's also the conclusion that I am prepared to share. That was the beginning of the Cold War already there on those bases.
That was Serhii Plokhii. His book, Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, An Untold Story of World War II, is out now, published by Alan Lane. You can read a version of this interview in issue 20 of BBC World Histories, which is also out now and includes features on the greatest leaders in world history, hidden stories of the Holocaust, and some political lessons that we can learn from ancient Athens. If you enjoyed this interview, back in August, Serhii also spoke to Matt about his previous book on the Chernobyl disaster. You can find that at our website, historyextra.com. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Thursday when Chris Bowlby will be discussing the legacy of Nazism in modern Germany.